Today, as I mentioned this morning, is a historic time. A couple hours ago, Dr. Billy Graham preached the conclusion of the last sermon that he will preach on American soil. An era in evangelicalism is over. Yes, his son will take over his ministry, Franklin Graham, but the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association has now retired its principal voice. You know, it's pretty amazing today that an individual such as Billy Graham lasted as long as he did, kept tried and true as long as he did. I was listening to a secular historian yesterday mention why he thought Billy Graham was able to last longer than other people did. And here are the answers that he gave. He said that he believed there were four reasons. He said, number one, Billy Graham utilized the means of television and radio when other people involved in the church were scared to use it. He was progressive. He saw an avenue and a means by which to proclaim the gospel. He jumped on it rather than sitting back and going, we've never done it that way before. The Billy Graham Evangelistic Association does not understand the words, we've never done it that way before. So he was progressive. The other three things that this man mentioned that Billy Graham did was actually what he did not do. The second thing he mentioned was this, that he believes that Billy Graham lasted as long as he did and made the impact that he did because he refused to estimate crowd size. He said, well, what does that mean? Billy Graham refused to fall into the trap of pride. When he preached, many times there would be millions of different people who would come over the course of weeks, and they never advertised 2 million people here. Billy Graham preached the gospel. They never made the headlines with the number of people that attended. You could find the numbers if you wanted to, but they were not publicized. Many times in today's modern era, they want to advertise how many people show up, what was the number of the offering, etc. They never publicized those things. They never hit them. If you wanted the numbers, you could get them, but they never advertised them. The third thing was actually the refusal to fall to the trap of greed. Billy Graham, as well as all of his associates, always had a fixed income. They never had a certain percentage of what came in the plate, so to speak. They had the opportunity to be some of the wealthiest men in America, and they refused. Up until recent days, Billy Graham's salary was the league minimum of a pro baseball player. Billy Graham in his younger days had always wanted to be a pro baseball player, so he took the salary of an entry-level rookie league player up until a few years ago when the numbers just went astronomical and got out of sight. The fourth reason that this man gave was a moral reason, that both for Billy Graham and his associates, they had one rule in their behavior. They were never allowed to be alone with another woman who was not their wife. It was just the rule. People called it out a date. People called it whatever they would. But it was just simply the rule. Notice you never had headlines with Billy Graham in a moral failure. Notice you never had the headlines of Billy Graham in some kind of greed scandal. You never had the headlines of Billy Graham's organization, some type of pride fall. Why? Because they set up barriers that protected themselves. I tried the best of my ability to get a video clip of the crusade that took place this weekend in New York City. It has been videotaped. It will be edited and aired at a later date. But I was able, before we get to Ephesians 5, to grab a piece of the transcript of one of Billy Graham's sermons. Listen to what he says. Moral problems are besetting us everywhere. Every investigating committee that we appoint in Washington finds snakes. The fact is, it seems, that few will stand close inspection. Business, labor, and government have all come under the searchlight and have been found wanting. We have been taught during the past few decades that morals are relative. Now we are reaping the harvest with dishonesty, lying, cover-up, and hypocrisy. This moral sag is reflected in the behavior of our young people. Quote, nearly a million teenagers last year committed crimes serious enough to cause them to be picked up by the police. In the last 5 years, teenage delinquency has jumped 50%. A Chicago judge recently said, the teenage criminals today would make Al Capone's gang look like a Sunday school class. He goes on, our generation is filled with nervous tension, a revolt against all restraints and a terrible gnawing fear. We become a nation of pill takers. We take tranquilizing drugs to keep us steady during the daytime and sleeping pills to sleep at night, with hundreds of aspirins thrown in between. No wonder Sir Winston Churchill once long ago said, our problems are quite beyond us. As a correspondent of one of our major newspapers recently said, quote, we are living in a night of total crisis. Anyone want to give Billy Graham an amen? Here's the shocking news. That's a transcript of a sermon he preached in New York City in 1957. 48 years ago, Billy Graham preached that sermon on May the 15th in Madison Square Garden. You thought he said it last night. And when I read it, I would have thought the same thing. Isn't it amazing that over the last 48 years, with organizations such as the Billy Graham Evangelistic Organization and churches getting ever bigger and more robust, we haven't made a whole lot of progress. In fact, let me state for the record, I think we've actually regressed. My mother was a professional educator until her retirement, third grade teacher. And the walls that were there in the state of Texas and obviously the United States, she was not able to publicly proclaim a blatant faith in Jesus Christ. Unlike this part of the world, the ACLU would be all over you, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, if you did some of those things. But my mom had a test to see where the children were spiritually. When she began teaching in the late 60s, what she started doing was this. She would ask the students to raise their hand. They said, if you know who Billy Graham is, raise your hand. In the late 60s, she said almost every student would raise their hand. And then she would ask the next question, what does he do? And they say, well, he's a preacher. Or maybe they say he's an evangelist or whatever. As she began to ask that question, she used that litmus test every year that she was teaching. My mom's final year of teaching, I believe, was 1999. It may have been 2000. I'm not quite sure. She said that year when she asked her class, how many of you know who Billy Graham is? Not one student was able to raise their hand. She began to prod them and give them hints of who he was, and no one knew who he was. The man who has represented the mouthpiece of Christianity in America has almost gone unrecognizable today. Because unlike the progress that should have and could have been made over the last 50 years, we've actually made a regression. As I posed to you this morning this question, if Billy Graham could get a church together of just Christians, not non-believers who is desiring to be saved, what would he say? And I can't speak on his behalf, but if I were him, and tonight I guess I am, I would go to Ephesians chapter 5, verses 14 through 16. It states this, wherefore he saith, awake thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light. See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. In a nutshell, in the New Revised Jeff Standard, it says this, wake up, time is running out. I believe that over the course of the last years and even up until this day, that we, the Christian community, the church community, even this local church and us as individuals, have made four major mistakes that we should correct beginning tonight. Why is it that we as a church are asleep? Why is it that we need to be awakened? Why is it that the days are so evil? Mistake number one is this. We have mistaken duty over spirituality. We think that serving on three committees makes you spiritual. It just makes you busy. We think having 14 different programs makes us a spiritual community. It doesn't. It just makes us busy. We have mistaken duty over spirituality. I'm reminded of the story in the Gospel of Luke where Jesus comes to a home and he finds two women there, one by the name of Mary and one by the name of Martha. Two sisters. They had a brother by the name of Lazarus. When Jesus shows up, Martha gets real excited that he's there, and she begins to go to the kitchen and cook. Mary, on the other hand, just sits at his feet and begins to listen to what Jesus has to say. At some point later in the conversation, Martha gets real upset, not at Jesus, but at Mary. And she comes in and she says, Lord, rebuke her, because she's not helping me. Now notice, Jesus never rebuked Martha. All he simply said was, your sister has chosen the greater good by listening to God's word. There is nothing wrong with service. In fact, we ought to do with our feet what we believe in our heart. The problem is when we mistake our feet for our heart. We have become a society that is incredibly busy. I'm going to be honest with you. It is frightening to me that when we have people, and this is just our life as well, when people want to go out and have a meal with us, we have to break out a couple month calendars. That is unfortunately the reality of our society. But our society has seeped into our Christian lives. We think that the more that we, quote unquote, do, the more spiritual we are. Maybe the less we do, the more spiritual we would be. In Luke chapter 15, we have the prodigal son parable and the older brother. And I know we've preached on this as of late, but the older brother thought that it was the things that he did that made him spiritual. And the father in that parable makes it very clear, it's not the things you do, it's the relationship that you have. We have mistaken duty over spirituality. I think the second mistake that we've made is this. We mistake past blessings for a recent or present reality. We think that because we were blessed in the past, we should be blessed in the present. Or somehow the blessings of the past somehow should just seep over to the present day. I'm going to give you four very distinct illustrations of how this has happened. Some of them may seem relevant, some of them may not. The first one is this, in the role of higher education. You may or may not be familiar with this, but there was an event in the early 1700s, began in about 1726, known as the First Great Awakening. It was an event that literally swept the United States of America. In those days, hundreds of thousands of people being saved. Men such as George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards and others were the preachers of this day. The First Great Awakening lasted for 50 years, a revival that went coast to coast. It was of such great prominence and significance that out of the First Great Awakening spawned several institutions that we're pretty familiar with. How about Princeton? We've heard of Princeton, right? Dartmouth, Brown University, University of Rhode Island. Did you know that all four of those, quote, Ivy League schools, that you have to be in the upper echelon of any school and of any system to be able to get into, that all four of those schools were started as seminaries? Those four Ivy League schools that today you will hardly hear the name of Jesus mentioned from, much less you might get in trouble for mentioning it, were actually started as a seminary because there were so many men being called to preach after the First Great Awakening, they didn't have a place to put them. A little bit before the First Great Awakening, there were two institutions started known as Yale and Harvard. Those are pretty prestigious, are they not? Did you know both of them were started as institutions for training preachers? And yet, I will say this, all six of these schools being Ivy League schools, there's probably not a greater group of schools outside of California, Berkeley, maybe USC, that are doing more damage to the cause of Christ than these. They continue to spawn person after person after person who not just refute God's word, but actively resist it. Yes, they're great institutions of higher learning, but we've mistaken the blessings of the past for the present. At one time God had his hands on these schools. Now man's got his hands choked around them. But there's another area that we can see this mistake. Denominations. Now when I say the word denominations, I mean Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians, Congregationalists. You know, you fill in the blank, there's a multitude of denominations in the United States of America. The fact of the matter is this, that every major denomination in America is decreasing and decreasing rapidly. You can run the statistics any way you want to, but the truth of the matter is they're declining. There are less and less people attending church. There are less and less people attending Bible study. And I'm going to tell you something. In 1957, when Billy Graham preached that message that I read a part of to you, I promise you that there wasn't one person in his organization that ever would have thought that 48 years later we would be ordaining homosexuals to stand in a pulpit. Folks, that's how far we've gone. It's been a slippery slope, but we think just because God blessed us in the past that we deserve His blessings today. What we know is the mainline denominations in America are actually crashing down. Due to the fact that this is some of the stuff that I studied, did you know there are actually major denominations now that are in talks with each other about merging? Because they can't stay alive. The churches are emptying. George Barna has said that by the year 2010, some 10,000, what we know as Protestant churches, will close their doors. They cannot stay open. This last week, I participated in an annual event that I look forward to every year. It's the Southern Baptist Convention. He said, Jeff, why would you want to go to the Southern Baptist Convention? What is so exciting about that? I'll tell you what's exciting about it. I get to hear some of the greatest preachers in America preach. I get to hear some of the greatest singers in America sing. And I get to see some of my friends that I only get to see one time a year. But as we were listening to the state, quote unquote, of the Southern Baptist Convention, it's not as good as we wish it was. Let me give you some frightening statistics. In 1954, there was a program instituted in the Southern Baptist Convention. Some of you may remember this. They called it A Million More in 54. A few heads are nodding back there that remember those days. In 1954, they made the challenge. Let's see if we can see 1 million people saved this year through the churches of the Southern Baptist Convention. That was 1954. Last year, the Southern Baptist churches in America, some 50,000 of us, baptized roughly over 335,000. One-third of our goal in 1954. Our current president has offered the same goal this year. I think it'll be met with the same results. It won't be. But in 1954, for every person that was baptized in a Southern Baptist church, demonstrating on the outside what had taken place on the inside, for every person that was saved in 1954, it took 13 active members of a local church. So in other words, if you had 130 people that were at your church on a regular basis, you could almost project that the next year they would have 10 people that would be saved and baptized. That's a pretty good numerical number that you could use. 1 out of 13, or 1 to 13 ratio. Today that ratio is 1 to 43. Almost 3.5 times as many people today it takes to see someone saved and baptized as it did then. Folks, that's not progress. That's not even plateauing. That's declining, is what that is. We've gone from a 1 in 13 ratio to a 1 in 43. There are roughly 50,000 Southern Baptist churches and missions. And I understand this church is a Southern Baptist church, and I have been one for many years. I'm just most familiar with their statistics. Do you realize that 10,000 of our churches, roughly 20% of the Southern Baptist churches last year, did not baptize one person? Not one. A man by the name of Tom Rainer has actually come out with a paradigm, so to speak, or a filter. How do you know that your church is an evangelistic church? How do you know that seeing people saved is a primary goal in your church? And here's what he says it is. He says that if a church baptizes a ratio of 20 to 1, not bad, a little better than twice what the national average is, and they baptize some 25 a year. A 20 to 1 ratio in 25 a year. Out of 50,000 churches last year, a little over 1,000 made the cut. Last time I checked, the purpose of any church was the Great Commission, and it looks like that's the last thing we're doing. Because we've mistaken duty over spirituality. We've mistaken past blessings over present reality. How about the local church? Denominational statistics, half of those statistics happen somewhere else, and they're of no relevance to you. I didn't go back and look up the statistics of East Boonville Baptist Church. I could have, but I didn't. But I will tell you about the church that I grew up in. The church that I grew up in is in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Actually, it's in downtown Dallas. It was a mega church before mega churches were around. Back in the 1970s, we were averaging about 2,000 to 2,200 people in our worship service. It was unheard of in those days. It's one of the 10 largest churches in America. They had a pastor by the name of Wallace Bassett, pastored for 48 years. Over the course of 48 years, listen to this, he baptized over 6,500 people. I've told Russell Volking this, who he and his family help us with our baptism here. I've told him, we know that we've gotten and we've arrived when we do what this church was doing in their glory days. The Sunday night service was reserved only for baptisms. Can you imagine if that's all we did on Sunday night? If the whole purpose of Sunday night, because you had so many people being baptized, that all you could do on a Sunday night, an hour service, was nothing but baptism. There's actually a history book written about the church that I grew up in. Listen to the title. It's frightening. Echoes of Glory. I.e., we had some glory back then, but it's gone now. The reality of the matter is this, that most churches have replaced the word glory with Ichabod, meaning the glory of the Lord has departed. We've mistaken past blessings for present realities. How about you as an individual? You living on past blessings? Boy, I remember what God did in my life 5 years ago. What did He do yesterday? Boy, I remember how I heard God's voice clearly a decade ago. What about today? And the reality is, most of us get caught up on what God has done in the past and forget to walk with Him today. And we walk around like a rooster strutting our spiritual self when we haven't heard a fresh word from God in who knows how long. There's a lot of reasons that that could happen. But a lot of times we live on the past rather than the present. We mistake our past blessings for a present reality. Third mistake. We mistake separation and standards for spiritualness. Separation and standard. In other words, if we don't go to certain places and don't do certain things, we're spiritual people. Folks, for every, quote, standard that we've set up, I can find atheists who practice the same thing. You know, it was amazing to me this last Southern Baptist Convention. We took a vote on a resolution. And for those of you who are not up on your Southern Baptist politics, let me give you a little hint here. Every year we make what are called resolutions. All a resolution is this. It is a statement on the culture or society that we, the group of Southern Baptists, come and say, this is our opinion on this thing. There are resolutions on stem cell research. There's resolutions on all types of issues that are out there. And it's all just kind of a year-by-year relevant issue. We actually voted yesterday, or not yesterday, this week, we voted to quote-unquote repeal the Disney boycott. Y'all remember that back in 1997? Southern Baptist Convention got together and they had a resolution. It's not legally binding. They don't kick you out of the convention if you don't do it or promote it. But what they stated was this, that because the Southern Baptist Convention stood for what they did and the Disney Corporation was standing for what they were standing for at the time, they said that we should not promote, advocate, and or support or finance products that explicitly had the Disney logo on them. They gave a report at the convention this last week about how many, quote-unquote, billions of dollars that the boycott actually cost them. We have a Southern Baptist pastor. His first name is Wiley. He actually pastors a church some 4 miles from Disneyland out in California. He was actually quoted in the Los Angeles Times by Michael Eisner. Quote unquote, that blankety blankety Wiley cost me a $10 million bonus last year. The standards and the issues that we brought forth made a financial difference in that one entity. But I'm here to tell you something. Just because you throw a boycott out doesn't mean you're more spiritual. Just because you don't go to certain places doesn't make you more spiritual. Sure, you set up standards and you set up parameters to protect your life, but it does not mean you are a more spiritual person. Let me have you turn to Matthew chapter 23. I'm going to show you an example of how Jesus addressed this. Matthew 23, Jesus is talking to the Pharisees. I know I've mentioned this to you before, but remember, these were your church-going, active people. These were the religious people of their day. Matthew chapter 23, beginning in verse 24, Jesus has a positive sermon for these guys. He says, "You blind guides, which strain at a gnat, yet you swallow a camel. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you make clean the outside of the cup of the platter, but within they are full of extortion and excess. Thou blind Pharisee, cleanse first that which is within the cup and the platter, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you are like unto whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within you are full of hypocrisy and iniquity." Ouch. What Jesus was basically saying is this: you've created rules, you've created regulations, you've created do's and don'ts and this and that, and that looks good on the outside, but your heart's not matching up on the inside. Let me state that if your heart matches up on the inside, those parameters will naturally manifest themselves on the outside. If a person is living for Jesus, you don't have to tell them where they should or shouldn't go. You don't have to tell them what they should or shouldn't support. The Spirit of God will lead them into proper behavior. But we've unfortunately, in today's society, we've mistaken that if we set up separations, if we set up standards, if we set up all these things, that we somehow have a spiritualness about us. No, we have a religiosity about us. So we've mistaken duty over spirituality. We've mistaken past blessings for present reality. We've mistaken separation and standards for spiritualness. And here's the last thing. We've mistaken information over transformation. We've mistaken information over transformation. There has never been greater access to the Bible than today's America. Folks, the average American home has three Bibles in it. They make great bookends and great paperweights. But that's not what they were intended for. But we use them for that. They make pretty good dust collectors, by the way, too. Particularly if you have a black one. It shows you where all that good white dust is in your house. We have a lot of information, but a lack of transformation. You know, today, at least on the cable system that comes to my house, I believe there are four religious stations that I can tap into. I can go and tune in the radio, and here in Boonville, we get three AFR stations. And there's probably more out there I'm just not aware of. I know they're floating around. We've got half a dozen Christian radio stations. We've got at least four or five Christian television stations. There's a church on every block. We've got more information than we've ever had in our life, but we've got less transformation. All you have to do is get on the internet. You can do any Bible study in the world you want to do. Listen to any preacher you want to hear preach. Listen to any singer you want to hear sing. You can go to church 24 hours a day via television, radio, and the internet, and it's not making a lick of difference. Folks, we've got more information than we have transformation. We can have access to any religious stuff that we want, anytime we want, anywhere we want, anytime we want. It's filling our minds. The question is it filling our hearts? Ephesians 5 says, "Awake thou that sleepest, arise from the dead. Christ shall give thee light. See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise. Redeem the time, because the days are evil." Let me give you a real simple litmus test tonight. I've told you the different mistakes I think that we're making. The litmus test is this. Is the life that we're living, are the words we're preaching, is it changing society? Or is it making us look more like society? Now, I'm all for being progressive. Trust me, I don't believe in the phrase, "we've never done it that way before." I believe if we've never done it that way before, let's give it a shot and see what happens. I'm not saying we shouldn't be progressive. I'm saying, is what we're doing transforming society? You look at the revivals of days gone by. Billy Sunday was my favorite, by the way. I just loved selling this, that my favorite evangelist was a Methodist. That messes up all my Baptist friends. But Billy Sunday was a Methodist. He was actually a baseball player for the Chicago White Sox. He got saved. He was a raging alcoholic, a raging womanizer. He began to preach in the late 1890s. He actually finished up in 1935. But in the heyday of his ministry, which was the late teens and the early 20s in the United States, Billy Sunday was famous for one thing. When Billy Sunday left town, all the bars and all the nightclubs were closed, and all the churches were full. When he left town, the places of ill repute were closed, and the churches were full. Yet in today's society, we keep opening up new places of ill repute, and the churches are emptying out. Folks, listen to Ephesians 5. Wake up! We've gone to sleep. We've gone to sleep and not even known it. We don't know when we're awake. We don't know when we're asleep. When I was in college, in fact, the summer that I met Tracy, I know y'all heard the story. I was a waiter at a local restaurant there in Waco, Texas. And many of y'all know I'm a night owl. I love to stay up late. I love to sleep late. Having babies doesn't allow me that second option. But I worked the breakfast shift at that restaurant there. I worked from breakfast from 6 a.m. to 12 or about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I was a youth minister in the afternoon and at night. I was doing double duty, so to speak. And I'm just here to tell you, being at work at 5:30 in the morning is not my cup of tea. Okay, it's something I'm not real interested in because I like staying up late. That's just not me. But I had to do it. I didn't have a choice. So here I was 19, 20 years of age. Basically living by myself. I had roommates, but everybody was here and there. I was responsible. And I remember one afternoon, I was exhausted. I had a long day at work and everything was tired. And I remember I woke up. I took a nap and I woke up. When I woke up, I looked on the clock. And the clock said 6:45. I went into an absolute panic mode. Because it was that time of year and it was that type of weather. I looked out the window of my apartment and the sky looked just like it did at 6:45 in the morning. And I went in the panic mode that I had slept all through the night and that I was late for work. I ran in the shower. I got dressed as fast as I could, left my hair wet, And I went running out the door. I showed up to the restaurant. I thought, this is strange. There's a lot more cars here than I'm used to. I went in and the manager that I was used to seeing was not there. The night manager was there. And I'm like, I wonder why they switched shifts. I went and I said, I'm sorry, guys, I'm late, but I'm ready. And I'll forget that the manager said, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm sorry. I know it's 7 o'clock. I'm an hour late, but I promise I'll make it up to you. He said, Jeff, it's 7 o'clock at night. You know what had happened to my life? I had hit one of those points, and I know you've done that in your life, where you wake up and you don't know what time of day it is and you get all confused. I couldn't tell the difference between awake and sleep. I couldn't tell the difference between night and day. I come to a point where I was confused. And someone keeps talking in my left ear down here. I don't know who that is. Someone's doing something somewhere. We listen closely, we might know where the police are going. But I hit one of those weird times. Folks, you kind of feel like that in your spiritual life? Kind of feel like in a fog? You don't know if it's 7 o'clock or night or 7 o'clock in the morning. You get up and you go to church and you go through the motions, but you don't really notice it making a difference. You hear this, you watch that, you experience this, but it's just not making any difference. Maybe we've fallen into the trap of these mistakes. Duty over spirituality. Past blessings over present realities. Separation and standards for spiritual activity. And information over transformation. Folks, what God desires for our life is a present day spirituality that makes a difference. Ask yourself this question. Is what you and we as a corporate body, is it impacting our community for Jesus Christ? If it is not, then we've fallen into the trap. The sad reality is that most of us look more like the world than we do Jesus. Jesus said, go into the world, but he did not say, become the world. Let's pray.